Okay. Hey Wade, how you doing? Good. Okay. I expect two times as much participation. Yeah. Okay, let's get going. Is everybody suffering through this severe Palo Alto weather? So you may have wondered who those students were on Tuesday in the class that were sitting around here. Well, they're students from the Shanghai Institute for Foreign Trade, and I don't know how they found out about my class or why they wanted to attend, but they were all here, and it was good to see them. And they gave me a nice gift. I got a big fan, you know, a manual fan, so that was nice of them to be here. So I should say, you know, anybody is welcome to attend the seminars, and I know we have some guests here today from that saw this advertised on the Stanford event. So you're welcome to have your colleagues and friends come. We got lots of empty seats, so that's fine. So agenda for today. First thing I want to say is that the midterm presentations for students working on team projects are 2 weeks from today. So get your mindset on that deadline, 2 weeks. We're going to have a little bit of a discussion about what's required for the presentation. Have a discussion on a case study of a project from 2 years ago. And have a couple presenters here today as well. So about the presentation, all team members should have something to say. Since we have 8 teams, we are only going to have about 8 minutes per presentation. So that makes it very, very challenging. So you really need to practice your timing and your choreography to make sure that you're within the time limit. I want you to email your PowerPoint slides to me the day before so I can put them on one machine so we don't have this turnover from one project team to another. It just makes things go a lot smoother and faster. If you want to display your prototypes and sketches, please put them on a slide, because if you have a small prototype, it's hard for the whole class to see. But if you have it on a slide, it makes it a lot easier. Any videos you have, I think it might be best to either send me the video file or put it on YouTube and link to it from the slide. Those are guaranteed to work. And any prototypes you make, be sure to bring those along. I should mention all these slides will be online, you know, tomorrow. So if you have problems figuring out how to organize your talk, you can use this outline. Of course, you're going to have to do this very briefly and concisely because you only have 8 minutes. So what do you remove from a presentation if you really have to condense it? Well, you're going to have to remove, you know, detail. Maybe you don't tell, you know, every little thing that you did, but, you know, give the gist of what you did. And the more things that you can show a picture of, a photo of, the less you have to explain. So make sure to incorporate a lot of photos. That'll make it a lot easier for you. You definitely want to discuss your project status, any problems that you've had, and your plans for the remainder of the quarter. Your presentation will be evaluated by everybody else in the audience. I'll have an evaluation form that'll be sent out. Basically, there's 3 evaluation items: the presentation, the process, the design process, and your progress toward a design solution. So for the presentation, we were looking at how clear you were about describing your project, how well your presentation was organized, and if you went through all the items that I mentioned. For the design process, we're looking to see that you've done your problem identification, your research, your brainstorming, that you've collaborated with the suggester and have a user in the loop. Want to know about your process for selecting the top concepts, any prototyping you've done, any testing. You should be at the point where you have had done the brainstorming and selected maybe a top three concepts. And it'd be good if you could say we're leaning toward this particular concept to pursue because of the reasons that you'd be talking about. So it'd be good to have photos of all that, pictures. In looking at the design concepts, we're going to be grading on creativity, originality, how well it works, and how well it will meet the user's needs. So that's what you're going to be scored on. Any questions about any of this? Okay. So I'm going to do a case study of a project we did 2 years ago because it's interesting in a number of respects, which you'll see. This is how it was framed. Basically, Robin Tobias, her mother uses a cane, and one thing that she noticed and a lot of other cane users notice is that whenever they're sitting down and prop the cane against a wall or a table or a sink or whatever, the cane always slides and falls down. And if you're a person that needs a cane, it's going to be hard for you to pick it up. So she wanted a cane, that wouldn't fall down. So they're always falling down. So she actually sent me a video of her mother trying to show the concept, but you'll see that she fails in having the cane fall three times before she actually has it falling. So let's see if I can get this correct. It'll take a moment. Replay it. So she props the cane against the door because she needs to open the door with the key, and she finally gets the cane to fall. And you see it's hard for her to bend and pick it up. So you notice the cane does have a wrist strap on it, which she didn't use. So the aim was to explore designs for a cane that does not fall over. You should be able to put it next to your bed when you go to the bathroom, it'll be standing right there. Would not fall over. So I don't think these alternatives were on the market back then, but this is what a quad cane looks like. And you can see it's different from a regular cane in that it has four points of support. But the problem with this is that the base is sort of big, and as you're walking, you can trip on these tips here. There's other models that, here's a close-up of the base. There's other models that extend the cane tip a bit. Here's one that actually can take a regular cane, take off its tip, and plug in this one. And here's another design. And this was pretty interesting. Here's a sort of a combination cane and wheeled walker type of device. I'm not sure how effective this is, first time I've seen it. But these are things that I found on the Internet that could solve the problem. But the students went on to look at several different concepts. And basically what they did try to come up with was a tripod stand that would self-deploy, that you'd put the cane down in some orientation and there'd be a couple legs that would come out that would support it. They never were actually able to achieve that, but that was their goal. And other ideas was to have an active balance system in it so that it would be like a Segway, but a one-pointed Segway that it would balance by itself. Electromechanically, maybe with a weight in it or something. I came up with the idea that if you spun the cane around, then it can achieve some stability. But that may be sort of hard to grab it, you know, as it's spinning at high speed. But, you know, just brainstorm whatever you can. So, about last year, this cane came on the market, and you might have seen the ads on TV. So this is a cane that has three tips at the bottom. And let's just look at the at its ad. And they have a video. I'm sorry, I don't have the audio plugged in. But I think you can get an idea of how it works. The hurricane is the all-terrain sand, gravel, snow. The hurricane keeps you on the go. It gives me more stability. The hurricane goes everywhere you go. And when you need it, it's out in seconds. And the proprietary pivot head gives you more stability at any angle. A lot of people stop and ask, oh my gosh, where did you get a cane like that? The hurricane truly stands alone. So Robin bought the cane and for her mother, and we'll talk about the results after the next slide. So I want to get your impression of the commercial, the design, and how much you think it might cost and things like that.
I remember the cane project.
Right.
And when I saw the, I didn't see an ad on TV, but I saw an ad in a magazine or
right.
a newspaper somewhere. And I thought it was weird that they kept the price a secret.
Oh.
To me, that was like totally weird why they didn't say it's $49 or whatever. And that's, you know, one thing I remember, but I remembered it in the context of the project.
Okay. Anybody else have comments? What do you think of the design? Richard, do you have any thoughts?
I think it's a really well-made commercial.
Oh, the commercial is well-made.
Yeah.
Maybe not the product. Anna?
I'm curious,
does
there come in like different
sizes? No. Might be.
Is
yeah.
it adjustable?
I'm not sure. It didn't seem to have any adjustability. It might, but... So that's an issue. You want to have a cane that's adjustable. Yeah, go ahead.
So in the commercial, you can use it no one forever, but
So your comment is that it may not balance in the environments that they talked about. But they said it worked on snow and gravel and stuff. But working, that's right. Good. That's a good point to pick up on. John, do you have any comments? No. Okay. Fred.
A woman by the name of Rose Carr, who's 93,
yeah.
goes to Avenidas for lunch every day.
Yeah.
And she has one of these.
Yeah.
She says God sent her. Oh,
okay. That's interesting. Okay.
Much better than that.
Okay.
Plus she has a walker, which allows her to put packages in a basket on the walker. And that combination allows her to go anywhere.
Okay. That's a good comment.
The thing that I noticed about it that was really good is the fact that gasket or whatever that has
the pivoting head? Yeah. Right.
So that the foot is flat.
Right.
But you might have it.
Yeah. That's a unique feature of this cane, as far as I can tell, the pivoting head part. So that's sort of neat. How much do you think it might cost? You said $50.
Yeah.
Higher or lower? Higher? More than 50?
Lower.
How much? Give me a number.
I'd
What'd you say, Raymond? 40.
Okay.
90, what?
1999.
Yeah. Okay. $150. Okay. What do you base that high price on? Yeah. No, I think it's just a. Oh, okay. That's interesting. Well, you know, maybe there's a lot of cost in the certificate of authenticity that you get with it. So they advertise this on TV, you know, that it comes with the bag and a certificate of authenticity. Yeah. So this kind of folding cane is used by some long cane users, you know, blind users that use long cane. So it's the same kind of design. So let's take a vote on how well I think it worked for Robin Tobias's mother. How many think it was it worked out well for her? Okay. But how many think there might have been problems with this design? Okay. Just one? Anna, with your predictive qualities, who do you think? Oh, okay. Well, here's Robin's response. We received the hurricane and couldn't wait to open the package. It turns out it's very poorly designed. The base has three little points of weight bearing to increase the stability, but it wouldn't stand on its own just on the carpet in my office. And if you touch it, it falls right over. It does have a wrist strap. So for her, she was very disappointed. So it didn't stand up. It cost $40. Yeah. Yeah. It might have cost more, but on the website it said $40 and free shipping, which I thought was a pretty fair price. So what went wrong with the student's design and the hurricane design? So with the student's design, you know, Robin talked about a one-pointed tip solution. And maybe that shouldn't have been included as a specification because it really limited the students' thinking on design concepts. You know, maybe they could have come up with something like this. And actually having a one-pointed tip is not part of the problem. It's not part of the need. It was just maybe a preference or something, just to get away from the stigma of having, you know, a quad cane type of look to it. So that was wrong. So a lot of it, you know, it brings to the point that you really have to understand what the problem is and what parts are problems and what parts aren't part of the problem. And in some cases, you know, sometimes you're given a problem by somebody else, but that's really not the problem. You need to look a little bit beyond that, look at the fundamentals of the problem. So the hurricane product only works on smooth level surfaces and it has a limited range of stability. So if you have any outside environment, like a sidewalk on a tilt or gravel or sand and stuff, it's going to be hard for it to stand. As you saw in the commercial, it was standing, you know, on very flat, smooth surfaces. It may not work on all surfaces. And if you want it to balance on all surfaces, you know, that's not the product for you. So, but, you know, we saw that it works for somebody, and for other people it doesn't work. So there's no one answer to any of these things. And this is really true in assistive technology. You might have a perfectly good device that would work for some people, but not for others. And they might have exactly the same disability. So a lot of times you can't tell beforehand. Okay. Any questions or additional comments on that? Okay, here's some other solutions I found in looking yesterday. There's actually a clip that you can clip to the table. This was a student project, and this is a piece of Velcro that you have to fold around the cane, and it's actually pretty laborious to do that, so that might not be a good solution. There's a cane holder that just clamps on the cane and allows it to sit on a desk. Here's another kind of clip that has a little pointy thing on here that you can put on a surface or inside your belt to hold it. Here's a cane holder that's a cylinder that you have to insert the tip into, and it holds the cane off of a chair or table. And here's a little spring holder. One community member in the class took a retractable keychain and put a magnet on the end of it and a magnet on, he glued to the cane so that if you lost grip of it, it would still, you know, be attached to you. But it might be a little bit restrictive to use like that. So and then if you look up cane holder, you get this kind of thing, an elf holding a candy cane. So a lot of different things. Okay. So next Tuesday, Terry Adams, hi Terry, will be talking in the class, and I should mention to you that if you can get your slides to me by end of the day on Monday. Okay, good. I wasn't sure.
I
won't forget. That would be great. And Terry's going to talk about the Stanford's Office of Accessible Education. But today we're going to have two students who were in the class last year. Anna, do you have a question? Right. Yeah. So anything to increase the friction of the cane against the surface that it's leaning to might be good. And just, I should say, the students also realize that in a home environment, you know, where you're always around. You know, maybe if you're at the kitchen sink and you want to have your cane, beside you, you can have some type of a clip that would attach to, you know, the cabinet or the table that you can do at home, but, you know, that kind of solution doesn't work, you know, in a restaurant or something. You'd have to bring your own. So that's important to know that, too. Yes?
My mother-in-law is 92, and she uses the cane all the time, and one with the 4 points. But what I want to say is there's this really great thing that she totally loves, because one of the problems that she faces is that when she gets into a car, it's really hard.
Yes.
She has somebody help her
right into
the car, and there's always bumping heads.
Right.
And she's got this thing that for that long that she keeps right in the door, in the little thing in the door, and it's a piece of aluminum with some coating on it to make it soft, and it fits into the little loop that the door closes and locks.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes a really great thing that sticks out that she can put her full weight on and slide into the car. So the cane has been put in the car, and she doesn't use it anymore. And she thinks that
and
moves in, and I thought, what a simple thing.
Right. A lot of these have very low-tech solutions, and one of the students is working on an individual project is going to be addressing driving with a disability, and you know that was part of the things that we talked about today. But you can envision problems that if you're getting into a car with a cane this long, you know, where do you put it? If you're in a restaurant, you know, where do you put it that you can easily get to it and stuff like that. So stowing it is an issue. So we're going to take a little break, and then Jules and Nicole will talk about their life after Stanford. So take a little bit of a break, come up here and sign the attendance form if you haven't done so already, and grab cookies, and we'll be back in about 3 minutes. Thank you. Hi. If you're a community person, want to get my announcement, sign up on the white sheet. Yeah. Yeah, John, you're if you don't get my announcement already. Okay. If you get my announcements by email, then you don't have to fill that out. Be sure to pick up an evaluation form if you haven't done so. If you don't get my announcement, then you need to sign it. Hi. If you want to get my announcements for every class. Okay. Okay, great. Right, yeah.
Does that work?
Yep.
You can hear?
It'll work.
Okay. Like this?
Yep, perfect. So that's forward, and that's the green.
Okay, and then with the video?
I'll take care of that.
Okay. Okay, is it a separate slide with the video? Did you do?
Or how? No, it's on the same
slide. It's on the
slide.
Same slide. Okay, so I'll just. Okay. I have a little bit of a problem, yeah. Is this yours?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Okay, let's get started.
Two minutes.
Yeah. Our first speaker this afternoon is Jules. She's a designer and entrepreneur who is passionate about designing human-centered products that improve the quality of life. She draws inspiration from both personal experience and observing the world around her. She came to Stanford to pursue her interest in human factors, human-machine interaction, social ventures, and the business of design. As a product designer, she is particularly interested in improving the aesthetics and usability of assistive technology. Let's give a warm Stanford welcome to Jules Sherman.
Thank you. Thank you for that introduction. Can you hear me okay? A little louder, like this? Okay. I have a little bit of a cold, so I'm going to try to project, but my throat's a little sore. So I was asked to speak here today to talk about my work previous to Stanford and my work after Stanford and how I got to where I am today, essentially. And I basically made things my whole life, and I went to undergraduate school at Rhode Island School of Design, and I studied industrial design, but my focus there was different than what I'm doing now. And so the types of things I designed as an undergraduate were really focused on form and material. And I was interested in these things at that time from an artistic standpoint. So this is a table lamp, and this is a medicine cabinet. And after I graduated from Rhode Island School of Design, I went on to design custom furniture for interior design companies. So I was still very focused on aesthetics and materials and interested in the transition between materials. And then after that, I worked as a contractor for companies, mainly manufacturers of consumer products and also retailers that created branded consumer products. So Cambridge Silversmith, Silverware. This is work from Restoration Hardware that I did. I worked for Bath & Body Works / White Barn Candle Company, which is a limited brands company out in Columbus, Ohio. Marjorie Bear Accessories, jewelry. Contracted with Forms and Surfaces, which is a hardware company down in Southern California. I designed door handles for them. And also worked for a company called Amarok, which is a, it's part of Newell Rubbermaid, which you might have heard of, and designed bathroom hardware for those people. And then set for 7 years prior to entering Stanford, I was a design director for a housewares company down in Southern California and designed products that were placed in the largest retailers in the country, so Costco, Bed Bath & Beyond, Target, you name it, my product was in the store, and did that for 7 years. And at this point in time, I would sit in my office all day and pretty much just design products. Like, I didn't go out and talk to users of a spice rack and ask them how do they use a spice rack when they're cooking. I didn't really even know what design thinking was at that point in time. And mainly, I worked with buyers of these large companies who had spreadsheets that showed me season to season how products sold, and then I would analyze those products and see why some products didn't sell and why some products might have sold better, and then use that information to design new products. Also did some food packaging work for Costco. In parallel, to working as a design director for this company, I started my own company and decided to make fashion accessories for kids and women. So this was a pet project of mine that turned into me traveling to trade shows and selling thousands of dollars worth of merchandise to stores. So I got some press for this. I made bags, hair accessories, luggage tags, kids' accessories, too. Worked on some bags that never made it to market. And then, towards the end of the 7 years, that chunk of time, I became very dissatisfied with what I was doing. I became bored. And I thought that there was something else that I could do that would be more fulfilling. And I decided that I should go back to graduate school to take time to figure that out. And so the only school I applied to for graduate school was Stanford, because I felt like it was the only design program that actually suited me and my interests. And so I never thought I would get into this school, frankly. I always thought it was like way too elite for someone like me. But in fact, I did get in, and I got in on a full scholarship thanks to the art department. I couldn't believe it. And so it was an opportunity that I couldn't pass up. And 2 months before I was, 2 months after I was accepted, I had my baby. So this was a very strange time. I was married, got accepted to graduate school, and had my baby all within 2 years. It was a very emotional period of time for me. And then, in addition, my grandfather had died, and I was helping my mother take care of my grandmother who lives currently in Florida. And so I was helping my mother navigate caretaking issues from 3,000 miles away. And that was tough. So when I came to Stanford, I really drew on these things that were happening in my life, and I channeled that energy into the work that I did here. And so for me, one of the things that I'm very passionate about is, let's say, assistive technology for new moms who might be separated from their infant at birth due to prematurity. So how do you deal with lactation, breastfeeding, when the mother and the child are separated? Especially the first 3 days during the colostral phase. So I did a lot of research in this, and I knew a little bit about it from my own experience, and now I have a patent pending on this device. I also worked on, while I was here, family communication tools. This is a what I call Monkey Messenger. It's a toy that you can give your toddler, and you can send voice memos to this toy, and the child, when they squeeze the toy, can hear the voice memo. And so it's a way to stay in touch with your child when you're far away. And here's a video showing the technology. message came in, the monkey sound would happen, and then if they squeezed the toy, they'd get the voice memo. And I also worked on, this is also a product for increasing family communication, mainly between the older and younger generations. We won some awards for this product, and we spoke at an Aspen startup festival for this product. This is my thesis project. I'm going to move a little faster because I got to get through this. But when I took this class, I decided to focus on PERS technology, which is Personal Electronic Response Systems. And you might have heard of it. If you don't know what it is, it's like any of these devices. It's the I've fallen and I can't get up device, you know, that a lot of older people might use at home if they're living alone. And if you look at these devices, what do they all have in common? Yeah. So there's low compliance in wearing these types of devices because the people who are given them don't particularly want to wear them. They don't want to, you know, broadcast that they need help. And also, they're fairly ugly. I mean, they're not personalizable. They're not really that attractive. And so I spoke to a lot of people here, mainly at Lytton Gardens in Palo Alto, where I was actually a volunteer the entire year. And I learned that mainly older women did not like these devices because they're unattractive. I also spoke with parents of young children because I thought there might be a market for this type of device for parents of young children. In this class, I created a concept, a suite of products that were concepts for PERS jewelry, essentially. So I created prototypes and, you know, showed them to people and then created more prototypes and showed them to people until I came up with this design. It's a ring, a bracelet, and a necklace. And I got some very good feedback on this just because I took into account aesthetics when it came to this sort of thing. I loved that project so much that I decided to continue as an independent study the following quarter with Dave and kind of get into aftermarket aesthetics. What could I do to a current PERS device that's on the market to make it more attractive, maybe more personalizable, and more apt to be used? And so I thought about this company called Jelliskin. And I have a Jelliskin on my phone here. You might have seen these. You can cover your electronic devices with an adhesive sort of material that does not affect the surface of your device. It doesn't destroy the surface of your device. You can take it off and stick it back on with no adhesive left over. And I thought that was an amazing material. It's made by 3M. And then I looked at Great Call, and I thought, wouldn't it be neat, in my mind's eye, if you could sort of disguise what that device was and make it just look like some cool little accessory hanging off your keychain or something. So I contacted Great Call, and I contacted Jelliskin, and both companies wanted to work with me, which I thought was amazing. Pulled that together, got Jelliskins to make a template for me, sent Jelliskins my designs, and you can see these are some of the afters using the Jelliskins on that device. I also thought about how young children might prefer to use this type of device, and I made belts that that had this device on it that looked like a belt buckle. And then I took it a step further with the children market, and I transferred the technology in the Great Call mobile device to a wrist-worn device that children could wear. So that's a speaker and a push button. That's a speaker, push button, which calls somebody. And then this is a LED that shows it's being used. And so this is basically a fancy mobile walkie-talkie. So it receives a call from a parent, and it can be, and you can send a call to a parent. And so it's just a two-way calling device. A lot of parents don't want to buy their young kids cell phones. So I made prototypes for these, worked with a lot of people on these projects. And post-Stanford, you know, I wanted to focus on health and wellness products, basically. I wanted to pivot my career towards products that I felt were more meaningful than spice racks and hair barrettes. And I'm not putting that stuff down. I'm just saying that at that point in my life, that was fine. But I was older, and I wanted to explore other things. And so now this is my client list since June. I've had some amazing work experiences just since I graduated. I had a huge research project with Orlando Health Foundation doing research on congestive heart failure and patients, caregivers, and doctors, and the issues surrounding discharge, and have worked with some great startups, Whole Biome, a biotech company, Salutron, which is a wearable heart monitor, and Great Call hired me after school, and also QMedic Health found out about me through a contact I have, which is another PERS device manufacturer. And on deck is Podimetrics, which is a foot ulcer diagnostic tool for diabetics. So, I mean, I went from designing, you know, garden accessories to now designing foot ulcer diagnostic tools. That's kind of neat, I think. I mean, I just want you to know that you can do this kind of stuff. You might be thinking, well, how do you get your clients? I mean, this all seems so magical. But it's not. So you have to get involved in groups that you care about after you graduate school. And these are some of the groups I'm involved in. Aging 2.0 is a really awesome group. It meets, I think, quarterly. And I've gotten two of my clients through that group. And Triple Ring Technology is a company across the bay that gives these fantastic lectures every few months. You should look them up. Very educational. You meet people there. Women 2.0 is a great group to be a part of. At Home with Growing Old is a new group that I just found out about. I haven't been to any of their events yet, but I'm going to be going. It's over in the East Bay, and it's an architect that's interested in aging in place with dignity and things of that nature. And then Bio2 Device Group is a group dedicated to helping people launch their bio-design products. And these are just some images of products I've been working on recently in the PERS industry, and then some packaging design and branding and infographics for Whole Biome. And just to wrap up, do I have a minute? I just want to say that this class opened up my eyes to assistive technology and the products in that space. And I'm not an engineer, and I learned in this class that I could actually contribute to this space. And I didn't really know that before. And if there's non-engineers in this class, you should know that you bring a different perspective to design, and it's needed. So I just want to say that, and you can pivot any, you know, a direction at any age. And I mean, I was 38 when I came back to graduate school. So that's my talk. Does anyone have any questions?
Stick around.
Yeah. If anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to. Yeah.
Hello.
Oh, thank you.
Do you think that the design and the artistic background that you had made your work in this space more relevant because you looked at it less analytically and more empathetically? You could relate to what it was you were designing for because you experienced it yourself as a designer. And you shouldn't, you know, put down the work that you did before because it left you here. I think that your background probably really taught a lot of engineers that were in your class too, a different side of them that maybe you cultivate, and you learned more maybe the engineering side that's latent in the other end of your brain. So,
absolutely. Yeah, that's so true. All of that's so true. Yeah.
Thanks, Jules. Thanks.
Next up is Nicole. She's a... excuse me? Oh, and Lexia. Yes. Nicole is a software engineer in test at Google on the Google Plus team who helps improve the accessibility of Google Plus. Her primary job is writing automated tests for Google Plus, and she often helps redesign core components for the Google API. Nicole graduated last year with a BS in computer science. She's been blind since the age of 4, but has always had an interest in technology and how things work. So let's welcome Nicole. Okay. I'm going to have a microphone. I'm going to consider it as possible.
Okay. Hello, my name is Nicole. This is my female black lab here, Lexia. Oh, and Lexia thinks that she's giving the presentation today. As James said, I work at Google and I went to Stanford. And I want to start by talking a little bit about when I took this class and why I took it. I took it for a couple of different reasons. Assistive technology is something that's really close to home with me since I use it a lot, and I wanted a chance to make some of my own. Also, I wanted to learn more about other types of assistive technology. I know primarily about assistive technology for the blind, and I really wanted to learn more about technology that people with other types of disabilities use. And finally, I took the class because it's not just about the technology, it's also about the people who use it. The presenters often talk about their clients who use the technology, and sometimes the presenters themselves have disabilities, such as one of the presenters that you guys will have next week, Carrie Adams. And some advice for you guys in this class. One of the common sayings in engineering is KISS, keep it simple, stupid, which basically means don't go overboard looking for some high-tech solution. That it doesn't have to be really fancy to be effective. I think my favorite one was one that my mom came up with. You know how they have those little writing guides to help you sign your signature if you're blind? Well, number one, you can't resize them, and number two, they slide around. So my mom came up with this really great idea. Why not just use post-it notes? And now I have some general advice just for students at Stanford. Basically, to try to find a balance between academics and leisure. Don't let one take over the other. And if you're having some sort of problem at Stanford, don't wait until it turns into a disaster to get help. There's plenty of help available. There's nothing wrong with asking for help. Just get help before, before it turns into a disaster. What else was it? Oh, and some of the classes that I found to be helpful, there's too many for me to name, but the ones that I found to be helpful were those that were interesting, that were, yes, there's always going to be some amount of work, but are ones that were really topics that I wanted to learn about. And I didn't let people force me into taking classes just because it was something that might be helpful for my major. I also explored other areas that I was interested in. And now I want to talk a little bit about what I do at Google. I'm a software engineer in test. Probably most of you are thinking, what in the world is that? What that means is that I write code that runs automated tests on other code, so that whenever someone submits a change to that code, if it breaks one of the tests that I've written, the test will display some sort of message along the lines of, sorry, this code here did not pass this test, please go back and fix it and then try again. So basically it makes sure that everything is working and that there was no new bugs introduced into the code. And my tests are primarily for accessibility. So what does that mean? How do you test for accessibility? What is accessibility, particularly on the internet? Well, there's a lot of different parts to accessibility, and I'm not going to discuss all of them, but one of the biggest ones, particularly when you're blind, is can you use the keyboard to get to a control on a web page, and then once you're there, can you activate it using just the keyboard and no mouse? And this can be not always straightforward, because sometimes the screen reading software that is used kind of acts as a middleman and modifies the input before it passes it to the web browser. So even though you press enter, that's not what's passed to the web browser. The screen reader might pass a click to the web browser instead. A lot of developers don't know this, so part of my job is making tests that will make sure that functionality is there, and also give useful feedback that not just, sorry, this didn't work, but sorry, this didn't work, here's why, here's what you need to do. Another problem that often occurs with accessibility is the difference in what you actually see on the screen versus what the screen reader can detect. CSS, cascading style sheets, is what is used to basically decorate web pages. It's what gives the font, the size, the color, and it also can be used to rearrange things. So sometimes that's a problem because, okay, maybe you have a button that when you activate it, it shows a menu. And that menu, when it pops up, gets appended to the bottom of the page. And using CSS, you can reposition it and make it appear near the button. Notice I said appear. But in reality, that menu is still down at the bottom of the page. So the screen reader is not going to find that menu because it's not with the button, it's at the bottom of the page. So sometimes what you see on the screen is not actually what's going on behind the scenes. And another way that that's problematic is when you have changing attributes on something, like you have a checkbox, when you click on that checkbox, it might show as being checked, but unless there's something going on behind the scenes in the actual HTML, the screen reader is not going to know that that box is actually checked. Another problem is sometimes trying to use CSS to make things into other things that they're not. Like, you can use CSS styling to make a link look like a button. And you can tell a screen reader that is a button. But what you can't do is you can't take away the information that the web browser automatically passes to the screen reader for a link. For example, when you click on a link, usually when you come back to that, it shows a visiting link. Well, maybe you can hide whatever shows that it's a visiting link using CSS, but you can't hide that from a screen reader. So if you make a link into a button and you visit that button, all of a sudden you don't have a visiting link. You have a visited button. What in the world is a visited button? So you end up with some slightly ridiculous scenarios that people, there's really no way for them to know about it because they don't use a screen reader. So the test that I write makes sure that there's not mixing and matching of trying to turn things into things that they're not. And then sometimes even the HTML itself can be problematic. Using tables to organize things is a really popular practice. However, if you have three columns of information, each one that contains different categories, what most people don't know is that the default behavior for a screen reader is not to read one whole column at a time. When you move through a table with a screen reader, you read one row at a time. So you're going to get something from row A, something from row B, and something from row C. Column C. You're going to get column A, column B, column C before you move to the next row. So all of a sudden, your nice three columns of information has turned into three alternating, you alternate between the three rows, the three columns, instead of going down the columns. And sometimes what you can't see, the screen reader can see. This happens a lot with images. If you have an image and you don't supply some sort of label for it, all you get is the file name, which is usually some long, irrelevant, annoying string of numbers. And it's interesting trying to explain this to people. And people do get angry with me sometimes when I tell them that they need to change the way they've been doing something when they've been doing it for as long as they can remember that way. And you really have to sometimes get them to walk in somebody else's shoes and realize that even though it might look pretty or it might look fancy or it might be cool, that it's not accessible, and they're really kind of alienating a certain portion of the population if they don't work to make their products accessible.
Paul, maybe you could talk a little bit about the project you did in
Iowa
last year.
Yes, so unfortunately, a number of the websites, and particularly eatery menus at Stanford, are not accessible. A lot of them use PDFs. PDFs come in different varieties, and some of them are not very accessible. So what I did last year is I built a website that was a SQL database of the different menus. And then when a user went and clicked on the menu for a particular eatery, it would display it in a much more screen reader user-friendly fashion.
Technology to show us?
I do, but I was thinking that maybe people could stick around after class to see it.
Well, maybe you could talk about the technology you use.
So, The primary technology that I use both at home and on my job is a screen reader, which is text-to-speech technology that makes me speak what's on the screen. I actually don't know much about how it works. Most of the companies who make it are very secretive about that kind of stuff, which really makes my job interesting, because sometimes we have to do a lot of guesswork about how the screen reader is picking up information from a web page. And also, I use a small note-taking device called a Braille Note that has Braille input for the keyboard and a Braille display. And the nice thing about it is that I can cable it to my computer so that I can use the Braille display with my computer, because especially with coding, it's very hard to hear all of the details of the code that you need to know in order to get it correct. Because if you get one character missing or one character extra, it really can shut down your whole code base. So having the Braille display to read on the computer is very helpful. Are there any questions?
Nicole, I was just wondering how you get around. For example, how did you get here today?
I usually use public transportation when I'm traveling long distances. I usually use a taxi. I actually stopped over at the Office of Accessible Education, so I got from the Office of Accessible Education to here using the disco cart service, which is Disability Golf Cart. It's a student-run service that provides transportation around campus for students with disabilities. It was very helpful for me when I was here. And I get to work at Google by riding on the Google Shuttle, which actually comes fairly close to my apartment. And then when I'm traveling by foot, I have my little trusty helper down here to take me around the obstacles and let me know when there's change in elevation.
Anybody else have questions? Fred, first.
You're cold. To what extent can you see?
I can see light and shadows. If there's someone standing in front of me, I can see them. I can see, I can't see any color. I see contrast. Like, I can see the crosswalk if I'm crossing the road.
Do you have a question?
Yes, I was just commenting. I learned how to do initial courses in developing web pages and so forth. Web page, I don't remember what it is now, but there's a standard for making web pages that if they're applied, and then if you remember to do certain things to web pages, then it becomes accessible.
Yes, and a lot of the times there's guidelines that people either don't know about them or don't follow them, or sometimes don't understand them, or there'll be a very blanket statement like, make sure it's keyboard accessible. Well, what does that mean? So just having the guidelines around doesn't always help.
There's some web pages developers who forget to put comments under the buttons or other attributes of the web page. They might turn a button on what they got. So they don't put the simply on what they got. So developers should be on to put those comments.
Yes.
Yes, there are.
Yes. And a lot of it
it is just knowing that those tools are out there, knowing to use them, knowing what the feedback that the tools gives you, what that means. And part of that is designing. When you design a good tool like that, it needs to not only say what's wrong, but also how to fix it.
Places where accessibility and computers are, like, are there good ones and bad ones in terms of systems, like Apple versus Microsoft, or iPhones versus, you know, are there companies or designers that are more ahead of the curve?
To some extent. It really depends on what technology you're talking about as far as accessibility. The particular screen reader that I use, the company that makes it actually works with Microsoft to try to stay slightly ahead, so that when Microsoft releases Office 2013 or Windows 8, there's not this big lag time between when the product is released and when the screen reader will work with it. Some screen readers are just better at taking whatever is thrown at them and just making do with it. Apple definitely is fairly good accessibility, considering that they have built-in accessibility tools. Like on your iPhone, you have VoiceOver. On the Mac, you have VoiceOver. I personally don't really care for VoiceOver on the Mac because of some of the ways that it interacts with the programs. I can't really explain it too well, but some of the answer to your question also depends on who's using the technology and how they're using it and what their preferences are. But there are definitely companies out there who are at least making an effort, such as Google and Apple and Microsoft.
Thank you very much, Nicole, for your presentation. So, please fill out the evaluation forms and make sure you decide if you intend to change your version. And Nicole will stick around and show off some of the assistive technology, and Jules will be sticking around.
And let's see if not you were applauding her.
Yep.
I've got about 15 minutes.
Okay.